This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wynton Marsalis is the best-known jazz musician and composer of his generation. Next week, he turns 34. The trumpeter has a new PBS jazz series for young people and a companion book called Marsalis on Music. Wynton Marsalis joined Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers when he was still a teenager. He later became the first musician to win Grammy Awards for classical and jazz recordings in the same year. When I spoke with Wynton Marsalis late last year, his brother, saxophonist Branford Marsalis, had just announced he was leaving the Tonight Show band, and Wynton had just announced he was breaking up his band to devote more time to his work as the director of Lincoln Center's jazz program. Before we hear an excerpt of our interview, let's hear Wynton Marsalis's composition, Hustle Bustle, from his album City Movement. Now, your father, Ellis Marsalis, the pianist, played mostly in New Orleans. Was that by choice or by necessity?
I think it was mainly by necessity. It was hard for him. It's hard to get gigs first playing jazz music. And he was struggling in New Orleans, so I'm sure if he had the choice, he wouldn't have chosen to stay in the city with five or six children and try to make it, you know, eking out a living as a local jazz musician. That was hard for him.
So he would have preferred to be on the road?
Just any way to play and make more money than he was making to support his family more. I'm sure he would have preferred that.
Did that discourage you from becoming a jazz musician?
No, because, you know, my daddy loved the music. And I remember asking him once when he had, like, was down to his last gig, and he was contemplating driving a cab or getting some type of day job, whether he regretted playing jazz because, you know, nobody really liked to hear that kind of music. And he said no. And he was very emphatic about how much he loved the music, and I had defined a lot of his adulthood and put things in focus for him. And, you know, then I was like 13 or 14, so I really, the philosophical implications of what he was saying, I didn't really care too much about that. I just wanted to know if it was yes or no. And he was fortunate in that my mother always supported him as a musician. And she would complain about the fact that we didn't have money, but she always wanted him to play music. She was never pushing him to get a day job or say, well, you know, you shouldn't have played this music. She was always behind him as a musician.
It's probably going to be hard for a lot of people to understand how a pianist or any jazz musician can go without working in New Orleans, but I guess a lot of the New Orleans music that paid was a traditional tourist-oriented jazz.
Right. Well, my father
Dixieland.
We just call it New Orleans music. You know, New Orleans musicians hate to be called Dixieland musicians.
No, but I mean the commercialization of
right.
New Orleans music. That's probably what there were more jobs for.
Yeah, and my father played a traditional job for a while with the Storyville Jazz Band. They played in a club called Crazy Shirley's.
Mm-hmm.
But then when that gig ended, he really was a modern jazz musician. So, you know, he had a very, very hard time trying to play, like, music that came out of, not bebop, but the whatever, they never really invented a term for the style that they were playing. But it's post bebop type of music. It just wasn't, the audience wasn't there for that.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest. At what point in your life did you realize that you had crossed a threshold and you were no longer that brilliant young jazz musician, that you were a man, you know what I mean? That you weren't going to be applauded anymore for being talented at this very young age. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I don't really know, because I was 19 for like 10 years. So, you know, I was called like the 19-year-old trumpet player. I was 27, and they were still saying the 19-year-old trumpet player. So, I'm 33 now, and I still have people saying, well, you know, a lot of cats think that you haven't been out here, and you shouldn't be saying, well, hold on a second, I've been out here for 15 years now. So I don't really know when that point came, because, I've always been serious. I always wanted to be a man. When I was a kid, I never wanted to be like a child. I had fun. I played ball and, you know, clown with my friends. But I always liked hanging with my father and all the jazz musicians. And it seemed like I've been around older musicians my whole life. I was always the youngest in every band. And I like the young musicians, but I'm not trying to act like a kid when I'm around them. I'm generally trying to tell them what I learned from the older musicians. And so maturity in adulthood is something that I've always embraced. And the older I get, the younger I act. So I don't really, that type of transition of being the young this and the young that, I never put any stock or faith in that.
When you say the older you get, the younger you act, do you mean that there's no longer this burden on you to act mature, since you already are mature?
Well, I've always strived, my whole philosophy has been to embrace adulthood. So the older I get, just the more comfortable I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not that much different from all of my friends.
This burden of being mature, was that because you were playing at such a young age with older musicians?
No, I just like to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't even so much a burden, because I could always clown. And, you know, when you can talk, or you can tease, or rib, we call it ribbing, you know, in New Orleans, or when you can tell all the nasty jokes, or when you a good cursor, or you can play ball or something, you get along with all of your friends. So I've never been in that position of being like the artist who's left out, and because my artistic aspirations, I never really shared that with my friends, the guys that I grew up with. And if they were interested in it, yeah, I would tell them about it. But most of the people I knew really were not interested in jazz music or what I was playing. So we would just play ball or talk about whatever.
So what was it like for you to grow up interested in a music that none of your other friends were particularly interested in?
Well, I mean, it was fine with me, because it gave me something that I felt distinguished me from my partners. I mean, they kind of knew, yeah, I went and played the trumpet. And they knew, because I had an article written on me in the newspaper when I was like 14 or 15 in New Orleans. So it gave me like a little reputation or something. But nobody ever knew for what. And Branford and I played in funk bands, really. So we were always a part of our generation also.
But there must have come a point for you where you wanted to play with other people your own age and play jazz. Was it ever hard to find other people your age to play with?
Yeah, it's always been hard.
It's still hard?
It's always hard to find people who really, really want to play and pay the dues that are required to play and to maintain their seriousness for a long time.
I imagine it's harder now to find jazz musicians than it would have been, say, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, I imagine it's harder for you than it would have been, say, for Sonny Rollins.
Yeah, it's harder, because most of the musicians that I find, I have to be the one to show them about what jazz is. Like, a lot of times it'll be musicians I met in a clinic when they were 13 or 14 and had my little brother Delphio to send them albums. Like, you can be sure that Philly Joe Jones wasn't playing jazz because of Miles Davis. Or Sam Woodyard played jazz because Duke Ellington. He had the opportunity to play in Duke's band. I'm sure he loved Duke Ellington and his music. But then there were more musicians who were playing. It was more of a field. Jerry Mulligan, I did an interview with him, and he was telling me in Philadelphia, when he was growing up, there were all kind of radio bands, and there were a lot of jobs for musicians. So if you wanted to be an arranger, you had a lot of examples. But now I'll say that 30 or 40 years ago, yes, there would have been more musicians, but let's say there are more musicians now to choose from than there was 15 years ago when I first came to New York.
Is this why you spend so much time teaching classes and doing concerts in which you bring young people from the city that you're in onto the bandstand with you?
Yeah, that's very important, to invite the youngsters into the music. But it also is because it's fun. You see, a lot of times when you're talking about something in public, unless you're telling stories, it's very difficult to convey to people really the fun of it. Because it always seems like it's some just a philosophical debate about jazz and pop music or, you know, but that's not really what goes on.
My guest is trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. Let's hear his solo on his composition, The Death of Jazz, from his album, The Majesty of the Blues. Wynton Marsalis from his album The Majesty of the Blues. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. What was it like at home when you were growing up? What was your home life like? What was the neighborhood like, atmosphere in the family?
Well, I'll tell you about my block that we lived on Webster Street. We lived on the side of the railroad tracks that the black people lived on. It was in Kendall, Louisiana, a southern town. They have ditches in the street where the ditches dug out. Some black asphalt streets we play street football in. And the sweet shop around the corner where they sell those pigtails and pig feet in a little red jar and Mary Jane candies and all of that. The gym down the street where we would all play. They had three black Little League football teams, Morgan, Pellerin, and Pollock. And they had about 10 white teams like Wentwood and Driftwood, and we would play them. The people next door to me on the left, once the guy, his wife shot him in the foot. The guy across the street from me, his daughter was pregnant by him. They had a woman used to walk up and down the street named Geraldine, who was crazy. She would be hitting people with switches and stuff, so we would run from her. We were scared of her. There was a woman who lived down the street in a yellow house who killed her husband on the Easter Sunday and shot him. They had a guy named William. He would be out in the street fighting with his wife. He would get drunk and whip her booty on a regular basis. A lot of people would be disillusioned because they weren't working and they were having a hard time struggling.
So did it seem unusual to have a well-balanced family like yours?
Well, our family wasn't necessarily well-balanced.
Oh, okay.
See, we were struggling with dealing with life like everybody else. We weren't that different from other people in our neighborhood. And then my little brother was autistic in Boyer, and he was born. I was 9 years old, and this was like in 1970. So our family life wasn't based on playing music and all this. My father was a struggling musician who was trying to deal with his responsibilities to feed his family. And he and my mother both had a great disillusionment, because even though they had grown up in segregation and they were happy because of integration and the breakdown of all these riding in the back of streetcars and stuff, the progress in the society wasn't the way they thought it would be. So this was right in the age when they started to dawn on them that their lives were going to fall into a certain pattern. So they were having to deal with that. And my mother was really dealing with the trauma of my little brother being autistic and how was she going to get help for him. And, you know, my brothers, we would be fighting constantly. We had a good time, though. Now, I'm describing our neighbor because we had a lot of things, but we thought these things were normal. I mean, of course, we knew somebody getting killed wasn't normal. But, like, we also had the Barclays gas station where you could work and you could go, you know, the gasoline then was like 35 cents a gallon. We had Burton's Pharmacy, which was across from there, where you could go in and try to steal you a little something. And the Clay's Church, where Reverend Clay had about 23 children. And it was a certain type of life that it's never been communicated, whenever my family has talked about it, it's always like, yes, and we sat around and daddy played jazz and mommy did something and then the kids pulled their horns out. We didn't grow up that way at all. I mean, you go out in the street and you would have to put your foot into some booty. You know, you had to deal with what everybody else was dealing with.
But was it hard for you to hold your own in a situation like that? Did being a musician help you at all, help your standing in the neighborhood?
No, well, I wasn't really a musician. They knew me for being able to catch them touchdown passes and shooting that jump shot.
Oh.
See, you didn't, I mean, nobody really liked that kind of music. Mainly, you know, you'd be in the community, like what's going on with Beyond, you know, Marvin Gaye. And I got a little house parties at Sean Jones's house. It was like typical Southern life for the American Negro at that time.
What impact did it have on you when your brother Amboyo was born and he was autistic? Did you spend a lot of time taking care of him? Did you feel that it limited any of your options because you had to bear more responsibility for the family?
No, you know, I didn't. It didn't really have that much of an impact on me because I was so deeply into what I was doing. That the fact that he was autistic, I used to tease my mother all the time and say, something's wrong with that boy. You know, just like teasing him. I didn't know, but he would be kind of strange to me, you know. But then I was 9, 10, 11, you know, a lot of stuff was going on in our house. And then when we found out that he was autistic, we had no idea of what that meant. You see, we were country people. So they said, well, he's autistic. We were like, good, that means he can draw or something. And then he would be hitting his head. You know, he had like a lot of these traits because he's severely autistic. And at one point, my little brother could talk, and then he stopped talking. I can still remember he used to say, get off the table, man. That was like his little thing. And then he stopped talking altogether. And then he just withdrew into this way of being, the way he's still that way now. And, you know, I remember in my neighborhood, there was a family of boys, all boys. And they were all like gangsters. Like, you know, everybody in the neighborhood was kind of scared of them. But Earl, which was the oldest brother, he taught me how to play basketball. So we were real good friends. And Jack, he was the roughest of all the brothers. Like, this was the type of guy who eventually all of these brothers got killed except for Earl. And I saw Earl later. He said, man, Jack died. Well, me and Jack, we were really tight. But Jack was the type of guy who was just real, real hard, and he very seldom would show emotion. But I remember one day when I was like 11 years old, I was sitting out on the street with my bicycle. I was 12. And me and Jack and I, we were talking. He said, man, where's your little brother, the one that's crazy? I said, my little brother's not crazy, man. He's autistic. He said, man, let me tell you something. If I had a brother like that, I would have him on my bike right now, and I would take him all around this city. So, like, that was something. It was a certain emotion that came out of him that I didn't expect. And to be honest, I never have had that type of relationship with my little brother. Like, where I really would take him around. Mm-hmm. Because we were always running up and down. And if you take my little brother out, you know, he would, when he was younger, you never knew what reaction he would have to being in different circumstances.
Does he still live at home with your parents?
Yes, he still lives at home.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest. Why did trumpet become your instrument when you did start to play?
Well, that's the instrument that I had because my father had gotten a trumpet. Al Hurt gave me a trumpet on my 6th birthday. And I didn't play it that much because I wasn't serious about it. But once I became serious, you know, I already had the instrument. So I didn't mind playing it.
So the music you heard around you heard the contemporary music that your father was playing. And there was the pop music on the radio. What else was around you?
Well, once I became a musician?
No, when you were young, when you were just starting out.
Well, we had all of those kind of little Walt Disney things of like symphony music, but I didn't really like any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Walter Cronkite was on the news, they played that Beethoven. Boom, 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 boom. I mean, I can remember hearing
that.
Yeah, I always liked that. So even to this day, and then once I started to learn in high school about Beethoven, he was my favorite composer, and even now I love his music. And I can remember just as a baby hearing that theme. And mainly it was pop music. That we heard James Brown, Marvin Gaye, Stevie, and Sam and Dave. We lived next to a barroom in a restaurant pool hall. And before we moved to Kenner, we lived in a place called Hanson City, Louisiana. And there was a woman named Miss Mary who had like two of the biggest breasts you ever saw. in your life. So I used to like to always lay up underneath her, and she liked to fix me shrimp, boiled shrimp, you know. In Louisiana, they have the boiled shrimp that you like to eat. So I can always remember they always had like some Sam and Dave on the radio, on the jukebox. And you know, when you're a kid and you walk into a ballroom, like those ballrooms with the black and red tile,
mm-hmm.
real country where they serve fried catfish and stuff, you always had that smell of beer. It was like in a place you didn't think you were supposed to be. So since we lived next door to them and sometimes they would babysit us, I would go there in the daytime and I can remember the music that they played on the jukebox.
Trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis. He's hosting a new PBS jazz series for young people called Marsalis on Music, which is also the name of his companion book. Our interview was recorded last December. This is Fresh Air.